So just looking around, I noticed some of you are in kind of a fogged gaze, and we are talking about mindfulness tonight. So I might suggest just getting on the right note here. You know how in the music they give me a C, I give you mindfulness. So let us show up. Let's show up for this. Good or bad, let's show up for it. So tonight I would like to talk about wise mindfulness. It's an extremely important talk, although I like all my talks on this subject. the reason that this, I think it's one of the most misunderstood and misappropriated steps on the Eightfold Path, because it's taken out of context many times. I know in the mindfulness-based stress reduction programs, they take it completely out of the Eightfold Path and just practice mindfulness. And I'm hoping to show tonight that that's really not in accordance with where the Buddha was pointing. And in fact, can do just the opposite, send us in the opposite direction. It's very important to understand this topic in relationship to the entire Eightfold Path, because without that, it doesn't really make much sense. But people, not to say that there isn't an immense amount of development and improvement that people have in practicing mindfulness on its own, I think you'll find that there is, that it has a lot to do with accommodating and balancing one's stress or difficulty, as well as chronic pain. It's very useful for dealing with chronic pain issues. And it, on its own, tempers the person so that they're less reactive, that their character smooths out so it's not quite as rough or jagged. And I say all of that is very true. And I also say all of that is not the way the Buddha was pointing. So we have to be very clear. Those are byproducts. And the byproducts are important because we feel accomplished when we see them. We feel as if something's going on, that we're moving somewhere. And I think that that's extremely important, especially to the new student, but to many of us, or most of us perhaps, because we deal with kind of measurement in terms of progress. It's hard to stop thinking in that way, especially in terms of our spiritual lives, when we're putting in so much attention and so much work, and we feel as if we need to see that there's some benefit that's happening along the way, some mile marker that shows that the work has been well rewarded. So it's very important that that is a form of character development, and character development takes care of itself. Either you can focus on character development and it takes care of itself, or you can focus in the direction that the Buddha is pointing and character development will still take care of itself. It doesn't demand your measurement and attention for your jagged edges to be smoothed. So it's very important kind of a crucial issue here, especially since I've spent so much time now preparing us for how to hold mindfulness. This is just not a talk on mindfulness. It's one of 25 talks I've done on the Four Noble Truths. And so it has to be understood in the entire umbrella of that teaching. Remembering that the Eightfold Path is a system for dismantling the sense of self. That's what its point is. That's what its intention is. It has very little value as a structure for self-improvement. Unless we understand that main point of the Buddha's teaching as the main point of the Buddha's teaching, we get sidetracked and supporting the mental image of ourselves with our mindfulness. See, our mindfulness is not some sacred thing. It just follows the way our view, we hold the view of the world. If we practice individuated mindfulness from a sense of wanting to improve with it and for it, to benefit ourselves, then we will have self-improvement. But we won't have where the Buddha was pointing, which is a dismantling of the sense of that reality and in the truth of it. You can see that, you see, wise view, which is the first of the Eightfold Path, is the umbrella that holds all the other links, holds them, it frames them all. In fact, every other link is in service to wise view. Wise view holds the fact that our separation is not the truth. Our wise view holds the fact that interconnectedness is a skillful means that points in a different direction than in terms of self-fulfillment or self-improvement or self-distinguishment or self-enhancement. So how do we practice mindfulness is really the question. Because mindfulness doesn't know. It doesn't have a direction. The direction is set with the view that we hold. And so each and every act of mindfulness can either reinforce the sense of self or not. But it will reinforce the view we hold. Let me be clear on that. Whatever view we hold, however we practice, that's the foundation, that's the reality that we have assumed on which we practice mindfulness. And from that reality, mindfulness will reinforce that reality because it's not questioning that reality. It's not until we bring our mindfulness to question that reality and thereby the assumptions on which that reality stands, that it is moving in proper orientation to the teaching. So, the understanding that view sets the frame of reference for mindfulness and cannot, in truth, be practiced if it's in a spiritual orientation. It can't be practiced without wise view. What does that mean, you see, in terms of practicality? It means that as we move in the direction of mindfulness, and mindfulness, if I can just define it, is the knowing that that the experience is arising, that the noticing of the experience as it's manifesting. Mindful of touch, it can be mindful of any of the sense doors. Or mindful of the mind, mindfulness of thought. But if behind the scene the reality has been formed that I am doing this, and with each touch it reaffirms not only what the touch is, the coldness or smoothness of that touch, but also the fact that I am having a moment of mindfulness. And therefore, both get reinforced. So if we hold the view, the mindfulness will follow. Now, I talk about interconnection, and I sometimes get questions about this. Interconnectedness is a skillful means which doesn't emphasize the sense of self. Because we're interconnected, it de-emphasizes the sense of me and you. And it establishes a question on what interconnection is, because most of us don't see that or perceive it from our eyes. So as we're experiencing life, as we're moving through life, a deep question is, let there be an experience, is better put, of this interconnectedness. And how is it that the sense of me is getting in the way of a deeper sense of intimacy and resonance and connection with whatever experience I'm having? So to take that experience again of the bowl here that I'm touching, the experience isn't coming back and grounding myself in the reality of words at this point, because I see that the sense of me having the experience keeps me from fully experiencing this in an intimate way. And so I don't bring that step back approach that many people do in mindfulness, where I'm stepping away from the object and witnessing the object from afar. But it brings me right up close to the object, releasing any need to separate from it at all. And what I have to let go of in order to experience life in that way is the assumption that I'm here and it's there. And then it's just the experience. Remember, when we practice mindfulness, that it can lead to heaven or hell. It itself has no particular path. It can be unskillful or skillful. And it's up to us to determine whether it's going to work, in fact, beneficially towards our spiritual awakening, or harden the reality of our individuation. Remember, too, as I talk about this, that mindfulness is not a step in isolation, that it must accompany view and intentionality. Intentionality. Because when we can't find a motivated reason for doing mindfulness, all we need to do is go to that deep yearning in our heart, that yearning for connection, which is really the correct alignment of that yearning that pulls us into ourself, not out searching, but into ourself. And through that understanding that the view I'm holding is the view of connecting, and letting that urge of the heart pull us towards greater connection, and releasing any obstacle which keeps me from connecting, that's the right path and alignment to use mindfulness towards awakening, towards spiritual growth. So see, how do we practice? It's always interesting. How do we practice? How do we start practicing? I don't want to in any way make it sound like we've all been wasting our time or practicing poorly. What I'm talking about is an evolution of practice, really. We all start off with a kind of a struggle with our mindfulness, don't we? It's the only way we know how to be. And we try to get the gears working. We try to get the things so that we just even can recognize what a moment of mindfulness is. And it's terribly difficult when we've only lived with ourselves enmeshed in thinking and the trance of thought, to begin to somehow extract awareness from the world that it has known, and the reactivity and the ups and downs of that world, the pursuit of this and the avoidance of that, all of these strategies that the world of duality contains, all of the ways that we try to counter fear and move towards the abiding of pleasure and comfort, all of that. Now we're extracting ourselves from that reality. A moment of mindfulness is a moment from extracting from that reality, extracting from that inclination towards losing ourselves within the experiences and indulgence and all of the different ways that this world holds out its allure. So when we find ourselves early on in the practice struggling so desperately just to know that we're breathing, that the breath has occurred, it's really because we have loved the world that we are leaving. And we aren't completely clear as to why we're leaving it. And we're not even sure that we want to leave it. Because what's at the other end of extracting myself from the pleasure that thought can bring is the bare reality of breathing. And why would I want that? Why is that so good? It doesn't hold up in terms of the pleasure pain principle like a good thought would, a good image, a good fit of imagination. And so there's a lack of intentionality to our mindfulness early on, and a struggle, it seems. And so there is a kind of tension that in the beginning our mindfulness seems to involve. Most of that tension is because of a lack of complete understanding of the limitations of one set of reality and the alluring quality of the other. Because mindfulness is an adaptable experience. We have to live some time within the realm of mindfulness to know why we should be there at all. And it takes a certain amount of time with that struggle before something develops in us where we feel nourished sufficiently outside of the realm of thought that allows us to really appreciate who we are or what we are without the constant thinking mechanism working. And so that takes time. And for most of us that takes or can take a long period of time. So I'm not in any way suggesting that the struggle isn't worth doing or that we're doing something wrong when we're struggling. It's just that we have to know it's a phase of our practice. And many of us stay within this phase of our practice because in that early period of time, the only view that we know of the world is the view of self and other, intense effort and self-accomplishment. And we don't often allow that view to evolve with us as mindfulness begins to pierce through that struggle and to see what environment, what opens up beyond it. We still hold the view of ourself going in to this new environment, as if we are now moving from one planet to another. There's a huge limitation, as I have mentioned, about taking ourselves with us through that door. Insight, the point of insight, is to understand that this new reality that we face outside of being embedded and entrenched in thinking has some value. Insight shows us that it's harmless, that we're not going to lose ourselves in the way we fear. We're not going to become what we fear we might become, empty or desolate or lonely or isolated or however we project ourselves across the iron curtain of that moment. Because you see, when we have formed around thought and our whole identity is based in thought, to think of ourselves, which is the only thing we can do, we think of ourselves without thought. We think of ourselves in the worst tragic terms possible. What could it possibly be like to live in another reality in which stillness is the predominant force rather than thinking? And all that does to me is make me worry. And so one form of the reality can't really perceive how that other form of reality could evolve towards its benefit. And so we want to carry ourselves across that barrier to make sure it's safe over there before we actually allow ourselves to go. And so we can perpetuate ourselves long into the practice when that's not the point of the practice at all. You know, I have told this story, but it's such a it had such a important role to play in my own development. When I was in a monk in Asia, I was practicing at the forest monastery where Ajahn Buddhadasa was the abbot. And he would talk about natural mindfulness. Natural mindfulness. I never knew what he meant. I only knew the effortful, mechanical mindfulness, where I was being mindful. I was having the experience of being mindful. And he would sit there under the tree, and he would not be forcing anything at all. In fact, it didn't. He looked. He reminded me of just another aspect of nature. The tree would blow, and he would talk. It was that easy, just being around him. And of course, because I was full of the tension of my mindfulness, I was full of that tension and haughtiness and just, you know, self-consciousness and all of the different ways that we hold ourselves within our struggle. And my conclusion was, well, I'm glad I'm here because it's a nice place to practice, but he doesn't hold much wisdom for me. See how arrogant we can be? Extraordinary arrogant. Just wipe him off the map. Years later, long after I'd left the monastery, did I begin to understand what he was doing and where he was pointing. And it's really an extension of that teaching that is this talk tonight. Now, some of you, I'm sure, are sitting there and thinking just the same thing I thought about Ajahn Buddhadasa, which is fair enough. But let me just say that there could be some truth in this. Just be open to the possibility that your position isn't the last word on this particular subject. And that insight will prove to be, will show you the truth of where this teaching is pointing. Remember that mindfulness, in its essence, is making the unconscious conscious. And if we need motivation, I was speaking to someone last night in the beginning class. She came up after the class and she said how much the class was meaning to her. And I said, tell me why, because I'm really interested in why some people really get the essence of it and other people don't. She says she had a 4-year-old son. And she realizes that she is passing over to her son what her parents passed over to her. And it ain't all good. And that last week sometime, she was in a fit of one of her rages. And as it was beginning to explode onto the scene and include her son, the eruption was halted by a moment of mindfulness. And so it didn't spill out into the environment. And she realized at that point that she could end the genetic history that was handed down to her and perhaps from the annals of her history, her grandparents, etc. And that she could see in that moment how she was causing the world suffering. And that this practice meant something to her because she could see the possibility of extracting that suffering and no longer inducing it on the world. That's what was motivating her. And I said, wonderful. I'll use it tomorrow in tomorrow night's talk. Some interest is needed, though. Some way to invest ourselves into this process, to give ourselves over to it. Some way to be drawn into it. Beyond just improving ourselves. She wasn't really talking about improving herself. She was talking about her lineage as a self. And taking herself out of that lineage. And so we too have to find some way that our practice doesn't just call for everyday corrections of personality and behavior, but has something much more in depth, much more deeply and intimately calling us for in this. Where do we cause pain in the world? Can we look around and see our actions, body, speech, and mind, the Eightfold Path? Where do we cause ourselves pain? And then we will, from time to time, become frustrated, you see, because the harder we try to master our mindfulness, an interesting thing occurs. The more forgetful you'll be in applying your mindfulness. Early on, the last sentence on a retreat our teachers would give us is to be mindful. And then they would send us out after however long we've been there. And that was it. I felt like a failure because I wasn't very good at being mindful. And it really, I tried very hard. And it wasn't until I understood that the embodiment of me trying was the absence of mindfulness. Let me say that again. That the harder you try to be masterful in it, the less success you'll have. Because you're doing it from wrong view. You're doing an inherent tool which is meant to connect us. We are using it for the service of our will, which in fact disconnects us. Disconnects us from the moment. Can you see that? I have to. When it's right there, what is needed or called for is not our force of effort, but our relaxation and ease. Ajahn Buddhadasa sitting under the tree is our release, not our leaning. Watch the equation of that work in your own practice. Watch your intense desire and your efforts be the very obstruction itself for the goal you seek. Remembering and forgetting is what the mind does. Have you ever been able to remember anything forever? And mindfulness is self-remembering. But the sense of self can't master remembering and never forgetting. Like any equation, it changes. What I remember, I will forget. And the pressure I put on myself to remember assures that that forgetting will happen sooner rather than later. So now we're talking about a different form, not the mechanical quality of mindfulness, not our striving effort, which most of us have to go through. Again, I'm speaking to a large continuum of practice histories. So I have to cover the whole histories. And you have to listen where you are within that continuum. So wherever we are, if we haven't completely seen that awareness is an inherent quality in the moment, and that we believe that awareness is something that we're contrived within the moment, that we contrive within the moment, that's the problem. We think we're having an experience of being aware, but it could as easily be seen that awareness is having the experience of the person who is trying to be aware. It's just a switch, but it makes all the difference in the world when we realize that what is inherently, where our intentions inherently pull us with the most urgency are the givens of the moment, not the fabrications of our imagination. It is what is already here, not what we yearn to have here. Now, there's a task that we all face in our mindfulness, which I talk about is, people talk about bare attention, which is just attention. But I think the process of getting to bare attention can best be summed up as bearing our attention, learning how to clean it up. Because we get into it, it's all messy. It's messy with our life. Our moment of mindfulness is full of judgment, if we're honest, full of contempt, full of doubt. All the hindrances are around the edges of it, if not in the center. Our sense of inadequacy and our efforts and striving, what we wish and our fears of not getting it, all of that is how we meet our breath moment after moment. And we've got to clean all this out. We've got to, that's what mindfulness's job is. And that's where the switch comes, as opposed to us being the obvious object of force within our mindfulness, or looking at what we're bringing to our mindfulness. When we look at what we're bringing to our mindfulness, we look at what this mind is doing to this bare attention. Because the attention itself doesn't contain all that. It's our minds that contain that. It's our minds that rob the purity of that awareness from being bare. And so we have to clean it back up. We have to know what we're doing. Moment after moment, we have to know the history we're bringing and the story and the reactivity and the emotional indulgence. All of the things that we can see if we're willing. But if we base our reality in the person, we think that's a given. Our reactivity is a given. Our doubt is a given. And we never question the reality because we assume the reality to be true. But when mindfulness is working in its right orientation, in its wise orientation, that's the very thing that it catches. It catches where the screen is dirty, where the self comes forward on this pristine screen of awareness. Where the self comes marching forward to color it, to distort it, to manipulate it, to force it to its advantage, where it opinionates it, right? And we'll see that there can be very little space. See, mindfulness is space. Awareness, natural mindfulness, is space. It has the ability to see everything. That's its quality, is that it knows what's occurring. It's like you don't have to think to know that something just went through the air. There's a knowing that that happened. So too, mindfulness has the knowing quality. It doesn't have to think in order to know that we're manipulating the screen, distorting the view, opinionating through our knowledge or our judgments. And we begin by that, by knowing, see what's happening, knowing what is confiscating our awareness and our attention, what's passing through it, to know the difference between what's passing through it and that which passes through. We begin to know the difference between thought and awareness. Awareness is the space, is the light. Thought is what passes through it. To know the difference between that is essential. Is essential. Again, you can go a long time owning the thoughts that pass through the screen as your own and using your mindfulness towards your individual pursuit of self-betterment. But when we get serious, we want to back up and be very quiet. We don't want to do anything to that screen. And the quieter we are, the more we can see. And so we don't lead with our opinions. We are very quiet to that. You get very, very quiet. Like you want to feel a mosquito on your pant leg. the steps of the mosquito, the individual footfalls. You have to be very quiet. And so too, that level of quiet and sensitivity needs to embrace our practice so that we are aware of whatever comes out now, whatever crawls, whatever footfalls occur, bearing our attention. And the obvious forms of that are seen, reactivity, and all the different emotions, and our reactivity to the emotions, and our histories come involved. But all of that, none of that is it. Those are just the legions of troops that pass through the space of our attention. And so mindfulness has an exacting quality. It's an extraordinarily clear, like a clear windshield. After it's just been washed, everything is seen. That beautiful exacting quality. But it also has heart, has objectivity with heart, with caring. The objectivity has some self in it. It's the slide rule mentality. It's that steel cutting sword mentality. But it also has heart. It also has the other side, the balancing component, which is called clear comprehension. You see, the Buddha didn't talk about just sati, which is mindfulness. He talked about sati sampajana. Clear comprehension. Clear comprehension of the moment is the context out of what that objectivity is being seen. So it involves the sense of what is needed, the sense of appropriateness, the sense of usefulness, the sense of tenderness, the sense of heart. So mindfulness, just the clarity, is only half the story. The other is the comprehension of what or how to interact appropriately within that objectivity. But it also takes that... You see, doubt is also negated in our mindfulness. And this is an important point. Just in our ability to know that we touch the earth in this moment, that this is where we stand in this moment, where is the room for doubt? Doubt says, oh, I shouldn't be here, I'm not supposed to be here, I can't do this. Is this where I'm supposed to be, or what is it? It's confusing. Thought will just confuse. But the mindfulness, this is it. It's not as if we could be standing somewhere else in this moment. This is where we're standing in this moment. It's not as if we could have another thought other than the thought that's occurring in this moment. So it begins to dawn on us that the display and manifestation is perfect as it's occurring here and now. And that what is there to doubt? Where does doubt come in? We don't fall back into the history of our sense of irreconcilable me's through the history of my time. I should never have done that. I couldn't have done that. The shame history, the guilt history, the complicated history of my inadequacy. No, that just... It's all gone now. So of course when the Buddha was having a moment of doubt, what did he do? He touched the earth. He confirmed his place on the earth. He mindfully arrived and said, this is the only place I can be. Where's the argument? There's no argument here. That's an incredibly powerful quality that mindfulness brings. Incredibly clear and powerful representation of exactly where we need to be on the earth. Exactly to the proportion in which we stand here and show up for it. And the second enormous benefit of mindfulness is that experience no longer terrorizes us. We are no longer terrorized by experience. Any experience no longer terrorizes. Because we have learned over time that each experience is accommodated. That each experience can be held. That if I'm willing to feel what that experience contains, that's the end of the story. It has no other antagonist that it can bring forward. And this is shown in the scriptures as the Buddha sitting down and Mara, who sits across from him, throws spears, you know, all the terrorizing thoughts and emotions that each of us have in the beginning of our practice that send us reeling are turned into the flower petals before they reach the Buddha. It doesn't have to be a Buddha to turn those into flower petals. Each of us have the growing capacity to do just that, to be completely free of the inward terrorism. And the willingness, not more than that, the willingness to face the disadvantaged experience, the disappointed experience, the difficult experience. Because there we see that our strength can renew itself and grow in accordance. And so there comes this, together with the fact that we are exactly where we need to be, that, coupled with the new and renewed faith that experience cannot terrorize us, there is this growing confidence based upon both of those that looks forward in some kind of not insane but sounding paradoxical. Let's look at this thing. The most difficult thing. Let's look at it. Let's just take this thing on. Let's look at it. I'm here in my rightful spot. And unmovable. Let's look at this. That's the confidence. That's what should be growing in each one of us. If we're practicing in accordance and aligned in the right way. Not that you're going to have enormous depths of anatta experience and know what non-self is. And perhaps that is growing in you. I hope it is. But this sense of confidence that nothing inside of you can hold you arrested in your development. And the willingness to look. Not in a macho way, because it's the tenderness, along with the objectivity, is the tenderness, the caring component to what is there. And so it's not self-enhancing, it's heart-enhancing. When we're enhancing the heart through our caring, the sense of self cannot muster its own persona. It can't stand up. There's no way it can build upon itself. In the rigidity of just truth, it can build. In the romance of just caring without the truth, it can build. But when it's equally balanced between the objective clarity of the reality and the caring capacity of the heart, it can't build upon itself. And so we sit there. Sakti Sampajana. Precision plus heart. So I come back at the end of this talk with the same question I started it with. Are we willing to explore the truth of our assumed reality? Not just assume our reality and move out from there. But to question the very reality that we assume. Because wherever we're assuming reality, that's where reality is fixed. That's where the notions of top and bottom are irreconcilable. Of me and you and this and that. Can we question not from those assumptions, but toward those assumptions. What is this? Because a mindfulness and clear comprehension, the precision and the heart, coupled with wise view, you get an image of something that might be, you see, the coupled with the fact that things are already connected, you get a sense that this thing doesn't need our abrasiveness. It needs the clarity of our seeing and the heart element because of things being connected. So let the heart come out, let the clarity come out, because the clarity needs to know where it is that I'm disconnecting. And the heart needs to come out because that is the connection. So as the heart grows, the sense of connection grows. As the clarity grows, where I'm obscuring that sense of connection is seen. And the whole thing moves in lockstep. If we're willing to explore the very assumptions that we hold the world. Who am I? What is this? What is this thing? Let me understand this. You can feel that from your intentionality, from the heart's intention. What is this? I don't want to just behave like it's something if it's nothing. I want to know that. Why waste my time? Thank you all. Can we sit for a minute or two? As we're sitting, no one has done anything wrong in their practice. We all get led astray. My job is to just keep bringing the light back to the road. So take an intentionality to get back on the road here. And to use our spiritual practice in the direction of our deepest longing, of our deepest intentionality. And the circumstances of our life are not important. Single, coupled, unemployed, employed, no children, children, none of that makes any difference. Not if you have the intentionality, you have the view, and you have the way to work mindfulness in accordance with those. Everything will work towards our salvation. Okay, good. Thank you all. If there are any thoughts or questions or comments or just points of discussion, please, yes. Because we're taping this, if people could make their questions just real succinct. So let me just try to wrap. She says that it's very hard to look at the sense of self with the language of self. And to try to, because even as I'm giving this talk, I'm using I, you, me, we. Those are just placeholders. Those are just, don't take those as truths in themselves. They're just functional expressions of language to convey terms, to convey meaning. Okay? Now, when we start bringing it into our own life, we have to be very careful. Because first we have to realize what we mean by the sense of I. When we just say it out of conditioning, we take that conditioning to be something real. I. It holds a sense not just of a functional term, but as something that is behind that term that has objective reality. And so we must first explore what the objective reality of the terms that we use. What is the sense of I? Before I use it in my free-floating way, what is it really pointing to? Now, in this moment, as we're speaking together, what does the sense of I in this moment point to in you? What does it point to in any of us? Look. What is it that's seeing out of your eyes? You see, it doesn't have... The best we can say is, I don't know. I hope everyone senses the I don't know of that question. Why are we so assured are so confident that we do know? When we look, it's, I don't know. I really don't know what this thing is. I really don't know. And I've looked a lot. And I still can't, I mean, if I've spent 35 years looking in the attic, and I can't tell you what's up there. There may not be a definable up there. So it begins to... When we use the word I, it no longer holds the assurance and confidence of the image of the established fixed. And each of us, no matter where we are in terms of our practice, can get a sense of the I don't know when we look. That's all. That's all. If you think you're going to see no self as something, well, you're just looking for yourself in reverse. You're looking for the antithesis of yourself, the shadow of yourself. It doesn't work that way. It leaves you with, I don't know. Which is fair enough because none of us do. Now everything changes. If we're just willing to hold that moment for a moment, rather than run from it, because it seems scary. If I'm confused, if I don't know who I am, then... But that's the definition of putting the insane person. Right? I mean, that's one of the 10 questions. Do you know who you are? No. Okay, put him in room 3. So... We don't ask that to frighten ourselves. We ask that to see. And we see the seeing itself. Remember that the seeing itself, the mindfulness of itself, is the established, absolute, accurate place of reference. There is no question. There's no... we're not in some kind of shaken, insecure place. It's right here. This question is asked right here. Who am I? Standing up straight, feet planted on the earth. Okay, I don't know. That doesn't shake me one bit. In fact, awareness, something from the heart begins to emerge with the truth of I don't know. And we go, whoa, what's coming out of me now? I don't know. But it's got something else. It's got a different quality to it. It's got a different sense. It's different. And it, everything I've so wished for myself in life is found, the pot of gold, the end of the rainbow, not in terms of pleasure, but in terms of contentment and ease. Within that, I don't know. It's what, when you were there long enough to feel its beauty, it's like I keep hearing about people who leave their body during a near-death experience and don't want to come back. You know, it's like, why do I want to come back into that? To that mess. It's not that you don't come back into the mess, but you come back into the mess in a completely different way. So it's no longer a mess because you're on this earth in a sane and completely accurately directed way. And that comes from I don't know. It's when you start thinking you know and you really don't, that's the confusion. Yes, I know who I am, why I'm this and I'm that, and then in a little while you're none of those things. In fact, your emotions have just showed the dishonesty of what you just said you were. And no wonder we're so crazy. Because we become so unfixed within our fixed need to an expression. But the I don't know floats, but it always embraces, always lands. Holds everything. Without any disturbance whatsoever, because all disturbances are from the loss of a fixed sense of me. And if you don't hold it to a fixed sense of me, what difference does it make if it's fixed or not? Any other questions or comments? Yes. Yes.
That you've had before, or
yes.
Your yes. And it only lasts a split second.
Yes.
And then all the old.
Yes, you bet it does. Comes right back and floods in, doesn't it? And your question is? Be very careful what your question is. I don't mean that to make you gun shy of asking. But how we phrase the question determines the view we're in. And she was saying, just for the point of the tape, that you can have a glimpse of another dimension and then be flooded with mind stuff as it tries, as the trap door of the mind closes back to get you back away from whatever terrible thing it just saw to the sense of me. And then the question was going to be asked.
Well, first, if that was something that other people had experienced.
Yes, it is. And then?
The watching of what has transpired and how much more time has been spent with the after effects.
Very good.
The moment.
Yes, very good. Very good. Because you see, and I didn't mean to put you on the spot in my, but what, it's so easy to ask ourselves, how do I get back to that? Because see, that's the unwise view coming back in. If you don't trust the unwise view and you trust reconnection, you say, okay, the connection's been lost. I don't know how it's been lost, but it's been lost. I need to reconnect. How do we reconnect? We reconnect through relaxation. If we're connected, we don't have to try to force connection. It's already connected. So we alleviate the tension that causes the disconnection. The disconnection is noticed where we're in pain. The question itself holds the pain. How can I the sense of me being isolated and separated from is painful. Let me go to that place where I am in pain, relax to that issue. And suddenly I have that moment again. It's so amazing that instead of responding from the reality of disconnection being true and then having to recover it through my efforts, which weren't how you recovered in the beginning, it was through your relaxation, I don't even have to ask you that. We're trying to recover it because we get a sense that that's where our spiritual home base lies and that the only place we know what to do in this is to chase after that. Chasing after that is coming from the old unwise view that says disconnection is the inherent truth and I have to get over disconnection in order for my life to regain a glimpse. Okay? Now what the mind does, because the mind is a disconnecting organ, understand that when the mind is working for us, it will work in accordance with the disconnection that it has been encouraged. We've encouraged it with that through words. So we can't word ourselves back into reconnecting. We have to be quiet. See, all the ways the mind tells us to get back to that moment are exactly opposite to the way we can get back to that moment. We can't do it through words. Words just continue to separate and disconnect us. You and me and where is it and how can I? So I can't use words. So I shut up. I see that and I shut up. Now I'm in the heart. Now I'm in the other organ. I've just gone down. I realize this thing is no good for reconnecting. It's great for disconnecting. And disconnecting is part of what we have to do to be functional in the world. I have to know the difference between myself and the door. So that disconnection function, mental, is something that I need to be represented, which it is, always. But that's not where my life is now. My life is down here. And although this mind tries desperately to regain a moment of connection, it cannot do it. It's beyond its ability. This organ is incapable of connecting.
It actually seems to be working hard to prevent the connection because it feels threatened.
Very good. She said it's actually working hard to remain disconnected because it feels threatened within the connection. It does. It loses its power. It loses its influence. It loses its image of being separate. And that, you see, this organ provides security through disconnecting and knowing. It disconnects and then it knows a lot about what it's disconnecting from. The more it knows what it's disconnecting from, the more secure it feels within that knowledge of what it knows about that thing. But connecting, when we're quiet, doesn't use knowledge like the mind does. It reconnects because that's the inherent truth of life. And that freaks this organ out. Because it's no longer doing what it was meant to do, which was to establish security and to know the world through that security. So we have to let it just kind of freak out a little bit and not be too bothered by it. We feel the fear, so we apply the mindfulness just the way we do. We feel the fear. We don't use the fear to react and to encourage actions from fear. We go to the fear and include the fear within the connection. We start including the mind's reaction as of the connecting, as the way we connect. Whatever the mind throws at us, we connect with it.
Except you're sort of in this no man's land because things are worse than they were before.
In what way are they worse? Okay, so you're in kind of a purgatory.
Yeah.
Well, you're not completely connected. What is it in that moment? You see, you have to look at your intentionality. Do you want for your intention, Alan. Do you want to be disconnected or do you want to be connected? You can go either way.
So you just set the intention to be connected and just...
No, you have to really want to be connected. Not that you just set the connection and say, okay, I really want to be connected, but I really don't, but I'll say I do because of... You got to really want it. If you really want it, you're willing to face and connect whatever with whatever the mind is bringing at you, including the purgatory response. Okay, I can feel this. I can feel this. I'm willing to feel this. I'm willing to feel this. I'm willing to experience this. Open to this completely. This dryness, this sense of no man, this sense of isolation, this sense of bewilderment, this sense of confusion, this sense of doubt, this sense... What? Name something. Anything. And tell me whether you can connect with it or not. Where is there inherent disconnection in anything? See, there isn't. If the intentionality, if we are at the service of our intentionality, which is the deepest... Okay, let me see. Okay, I'm confused. Great, good, let me feel that. Nothing, it can't put anything up. Now, if we don't really want, if we believe in the fear and we don't really want it because we feel like the fear has some truth and that it's just going to send us into hell, then we're probably better to go back and go to the refrigerator door and help ourselves. Because that'll get us back, or take a shower or something, or go out and do something pleasurable, because that'll get us back into the body of enjoyment and pleasure and pain. Doesn't work. Okay, so you see that. Now you have to be resolute in your willingness to hold whatever the mind comes at you to disconnect with connection. I'm willing, just opening. Okay, yeah, feeling it completely. It doesn't have... It may feel as if it has a whole array of an arsenal back there, like a whole armory. It doesn't. In fact, once you go like this, it shuts up because it knows it can't get you to close down. Once it knows you're not going to give up your seat because you are here, then it gives up. But as long as it thinks it can get you to stir in its direction, which it still can, it's not going to give up. You see the paradox? Okay. Thank you all. Wow.